Thank you for standing by, and welcome to the ANZ Trading Update. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. There will be a presentation followed by a question-and-answer session, at which time, if you wish to ask a question, you will need to press star followed by the number one on your telephone keypad. I must advise you that this conference is being recorded today, Friday the 19th of August, 2011. I would now like to hand the conference over to your speaker today, Jill Craig, Group General Manager, Investor Relations. Please go ahead, Ms. Craig.
Thanks, Kay, and good morning, everyone. Welcome to the conference call for the ANZ Trading Update for the third quarter of financial year 2011. We released several documents this morning, the media release, the APS 330 to the end of June, and the New Zealand GDS. Hopefully you've had a chance to have a look at all of those documents. As usual, with me this morning, our CEO, Mike Smith, and our CFO, Peter Marriott. They'll speak for around 10 minutes or so, and then we'll get pretty quickly into Q&A. Thanks, Mike.
Okay, many thanks, Jill, and good morning to everyone. Well, a great day in the markets for a trading update. Thanks for picking that one, Jill. You will have seen our ASX announcement this morning covering the nine-month period to the end of June and some commentary on the economic environment in which we're operating. In summary, despite the economic volatility that we're seeing, we have a clear strategy that's helped position us ahead of the curve by being focused on the right part of the world and the right customer segments. And we've supported that with a consistent focus on building a very strong balance sheet. I also believe that the Australian economy is in pretty good shape despite the short-term challenges. And I'm confident about the long-term opportunities for Australia and for New Zealand because of our linkage to Asia. Looking through the noise of the last fortnight and even today, it means that I'm still optimistic and that I believe that there is still significant upside in our strategy for ANZ. Now, if I turn to the update and look at the customer franchises in Australia, New Zealand and Asia Pacific, you'll see that they're all continuing to perform well. In the Australian division, we've seen a continuation of strong deposit growth, and that's trended across all parts of the business. We have re-established momentum in mortgages, and there are some positive signs emerging in commercial lending. Importantly, we've also seen a downward trend in the 30 and 90-day mortgage delinquencies after they peaked when I spoke to you in May. And we have added, actually, additional resources to ensure that this is maintained. Our growing exposure to Asia is continuing to be a source of strength and, of course, of differentiation for the group. The APA division is continuing to aggressively build out the business, focusing on improving the quality and the diversity of our earnings streams. Pleasingly, we're now, at an early stage, but we're making good progress with the retail and wealth businesses on the back of the acquisition we made from RBS in 2009. In New Zealand, the economy has proved to be quite resilient despite the Christchurch earthquake, and it's continuing a slow recovery. And I think importantly, though, our business there is making steady progress with its strategy to simplify the business, to reduce its cost base, and to ensure that our businesses are working together in a much more coordinated way. In institutional, the division has made very significant progress over the last 3 years in strengthening its regional positioning, and we're seeing the result of that in higher customer acquisition and in strong growth in trade finance, in lending, and in debt capital markets. Consistent with what you are seeing at other banks, both domestically and globally, we've seen lower trading income in the quarter in our global markets business compared to last year, although this has been partially offset by strong growth in customer-driven revenue, which is up 10% quarter-on-quarter and about 9% on the same nine-month period last year. Now, clearly this isn't brilliant in the sense that the difficult market conditions have actually continued into July and, of course, into August. But this is something that all banks have been managing over the past few months, and we're no different. So, I'm not going to overreact. We have the right strategy for the business, which emphasizes customer revenue growth. We have the right team in place, and we expect the performance to normalize as market conditions ease over time. So our customer franchises are continuing to perform well, and we're making good progress with our super-regional strategy and its focus on the broader Asia-Pacific region. But I know the issue for investors is looking ahead and trying to get a picture of how the current volatility will play out, the economic outlook, and, of course, what that means to us. I've been saying for some time that the vulnerabilities that built up in the world economy prior to the financial crisis would take some time to work through. You know, Europe is frankly a mess with quite genuine concerns, you know, about the sovereignty of countries like Greece, Ireland, Portugal, and, of course, you know, the contagion effect that has and the challenge that creates for countries like Italy and Spain. In the United States, which I'm normally much more optimistic about, we've seen a crisis which has been created by partisan nature of its current politics, and that's created further concern to what was already a pretty fragile recovery. I think the massive volatility that we've seen in global markets since the S&P downgrade of the United States is clearly a signal that markets are now concerned about softer growth in most advanced economies and a lack of a clear plan from policymakers. And I think, you know, it's fair to say that right now this is all very delicately poised. I think further missteps from European and US policymakers really risk converting the cracks in their economies into a much deeper global system crisis, which would have worrying economic and social consequences. Now, while there are some short-term challenges here in Australia and as well in New Zealand, actually I remain quite optimistic. The fact is that we are incredibly well positioned because of our linkages to Asia, which remains the best performing part of the global economy, with growth in China running at about just over 9% this year, and at the region at over 6% ex-Japan. And our latest forecasts don't see that changing much next year. We'll see this driving the performance of the resources, the agriculture, and the infrastructure sectors, which are now joined at the hip to Asia's process of industrialization and urbanization. And although there will be volatility in commodity prices, there is very clearly significant upside for those sectors for the next 20 years or more. Now, that doesn't mean there are not risks. No region or country is risk-free, but it's clear that Asia, led by China and India, are going to continue to be the best performing parts of the global economy. And although there are concerns over commodity and asset price inflation and currency imbalances, the issue actually is too much growth, not too little, and the region remains an enormous opportunity for Australia. Now, Australian consumers are reacting to the uncertain global and domestic environment and are being cautious. You know, they are focusing on bolstering household balance sheets by saving more and by paying down debt. In the banking sector, we are seeing this in lower levels of credit growth, although we are expecting business credit growth to grow in 2012 after several quite weak years. And that's consistent with the early signs we are seeing in our commercial business. What's unfolding, however, confirms our long-held view that the change reality following the global financial crisis is not a temporary issue. I've emphasized to you over the last couple of years that we recognize this early, and we've been working hard to position ourselves appropriately. First, we recognize the shift in the global growth to Asia, and we've positioned ANZ to take advantage of this. We've focused the group on building a real presence in Asia and in our key domestic franchises in Australia and New Zealand, and we have a clear strategy around capturing the trade and investment flows within the region. As I said before, this is a source of strength and of real differentiation, and I remain of the view that the situation in Europe will continue to throw up opportunities for us. You know, I have been saying this to you for 3 years, and at some stage it must be true. But I think it's now even more obvious than it was. Second, we've had a consistent focus on building what is now an exceptionally strong balance sheet. We have dramatically improved our loan-to-deposit ratio, and we've reduced our reliance on wholesale funding. So far this year, deposit growth has exceeded loan growth by about $15 billion, and customer deposits now represent 62% of ANZ's funding base, which is up from 50% about 3 years ago. The group's Tier 1 capital ratio at the end of June was 10.5%. Now, if you were to calculate that on an FSA basis in the UK, That would equate to 13.6%. Core Tier 1 was 8.5%, or about 9.5% on a fully harmonized Basel III basis, if we ever see a full harmonization of Basel III. Our provision coverage also remains high, with the total provision coverage ratio at about 2.1% of credit risk-weighted assets. And our liquid asset holdings now provide cover for all of our outstanding foreign currency debt securities. So there's no question the global environment is difficult, but the bottom line is that we're very well positioned, and there's still significant upside across all our businesses. Our expertise in resources, agribusiness and infrastructure is delivering. The consistent investment that we've made in our operational hubs is allowing us to drive further productivity, and we still have significant upside to play out through our hubs as they really do develop into proper centres of excellence. We'll continue to manage our balance sheet conservatively, and although we are running a higher revenue growth, higher cost model, we have and we will continue to cut our cloth to suit our circumstances, and that means the business circumstances and indeed the what is relevant in the overall economic outlook. This isn't a matter of reacting to events, but of dynamically managing our cost base so that they reflect our business strategy and the market conditions we operate in. An example of this is in Apia. The business has moved from a phase where we had to get the engine firing on all cylinders, where we are building out the business and integrating the RBS acquisitions, to what is now a more mature phase where we can continue to invest, but with a very strong cost discipline. And in institutional, we have parts of the business where revenue is soft, and so we'll adjust for that. On technology, we now have a very clear roadmap aligned to our super-regional ambition that we're executing against. Already, we've made very good progress in developing global systems to support our cash management business, our trade finance business, and our markets business. So let me finish by saying that despite global economic turbulence, which has impacted the trading book, we have a clear and unique strategy. We are in the right markets, and we have had steady momentum in our customer franchises. And all of this allows us to be cautiously optimistic about our prospects. Now, before we open up to question, we'll get to the moment that you've all been waiting for, which is Peter to make a few comments about the APS 330.
Oh, well, thank you, Mike, for that sort of introduction. I'm sure everyone's really excited. Look, I, and unfortunately, I don't think there's any surprises in the APS 330. There's no surprises, and indeed some improving trends. Look, from a core Tier 1 ratio point of view, core Tier 1 ratio is up from 8.49 at March to 8.61, 1%. Risk-weighted assets, you would have noticed, have grown around about 1.6%. It's essentially all coming out of credit risk-weighted assets, which have been up 1.9% or around $4.4 billion. And has been primarily driven by growth in our lending, and you've seen lending has been up in the quarter. Risk profile has actually improved, and so from the credit risk-weighted assets were pushed down slightly by that. You would have actually been interested to know that 59% of our lending growth actually came out of Apia in the quarter. New Zealand was down and Australia had modest growth. From an expected loss versus eligible provisions, very small change there. I think the impact is about less than one basis point on the core Tier 1 ratio. Primarily it's been the impact of the growing credit risk-weighted assets. Our impaired assets are a good trend, continuing the trend we've seen over the recent quarters, down about 4% or $260 million. And that's particularly coming from the corporate and specialised lending asset classes. If you look at it at a divisional level, New Zealand's down about 8%, institutional's down about 6%, and Australia division's up about 6%, but that's only $63 million. So it's a small number. New impaired assets have continued to go down. They're now less than $1 billion this quarter, around about $980 million this quarter. That's been down everywhere except for a modest increase in Australia, up about 2%. In particular, the institutional new impaired assets are now back to June 2008 levels, so back to levels prior to the global financial crisis. You were seeing that 90 days was up about $173 million. 60% of that is mortgages. As Mike said, the mortgages arrears peaked. They peaked in May, and since then have been coming down. They came down to the end of June and came down to the end of July. From an IP charge point of view, the growth that you have seen there quarter on quarter is driven both by seasonal factors in cards and secondly earthquake effects. You've got about a growth in the Australian division of $18 million and $13 million of that is cards, where there's always a seasonal kick up and there's an offsetting effect in the CP. And in New Zealand, there's an increase of about $20 million, and yes, and about $20 million is also our earthquake effect coming out of New Zealand. Institutional was flat in its provisions. The collective provision was a release of $10 million. I stress that there has been no overlay release in that number beyond releasing CP in New Zealand to match the amount of earthquake IPs that have come through. So it's simply been matching one for one. Obviously that CP charge though is down substantially on Q2 because Q2 had the flood provision being taken up here within Australia. On the CP balance overall, we're around about 1.34% of credit risk weighted assets. And that's down 2 basis points, and that's simply because of credit risk weighted asset growth and that small $10 million release of collective provision associated with the earthquakes. So, as I said, I don't think there's any surprises in there, and indeed some improving trends, particularly in terms of arrears now seemingly having peaked, and also the lower rate of new impaired assets and impaired assets in total. So with that, Jill, hand back to you to open up for questions.
Thanks, Peter. So over to you, Kay.
We will now begin the question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question, please press star followed by the number 1 on your keypad and wait for your name to be announced. If you wish to cancel your request, please press the star key followed by the number 2. We will now move to our first question from the line of Ben Koo from Goldman Sachs. Please go ahead.
Hi Mike, just wanted to get a feel for the revenue outlook of the business generally, and in particular I think you made some comments about margins in the press release, how the deposit margins have been a little bit weaker. I just wanted to see if that's been easing off, and secondly also just when the trading side of things, has there been any change in the way that you're looking at the trading book now given the volatility? VaR limits for a lot of investment banks have been reducing. I'm just trying to see if there's actually been any structural change besides just maybe a reduction in risk being taken.
Yeah, on the first question, I mean, you know, the income outlook is pretty good. You know, I think that in terms of margin, we've managed to maintain the margin. In fact, we increased it ex markets by a couple of basis points. That trend, I think, will continue for the rest of the year. You know, we'll probably hold the margin. The main reason is that you're right that the deposit rate. Or the competition in deposit rates has eased a little bit, so that has helped. I think in terms of the trading book, you know, over the last couple of weeks and whatever, we've basically maintained a sort of neutral trading book, basically working on the basis of making sure that there is no downside, but equally, of course, there's no upside. It's really just pulling the horns in a bit and just waiting for things to settle down, because it's very difficult to read where rates are going. You know, they've fluctuated so wildly, both sides of, going up and down. And, you know, the feeling at the moment is just to let this one play out a bit. And, you know, the real issue here is more in the liquidity book. You know, the government and semi-government bonds we hold as liquidity reserves under the Basel III requirements, which we actually hold in a mark-to-market book. You know, some banks actually account for that on an accrual basis. We choose to use a mark-to-market. But, of course, that will come back in the longer term.
So no structural change to the trading teams or anything like that?
Oh, no, absolutely not. No, I think we've got the right, you know, we've got an excellent team of people in place.
Great, thank you.
Our next question comes from the line of Victor German from Nomura. Please go ahead.
Yes, good morning. I was hoping to first of all confirm on the margins, and I think Mike, you sort of made some comments, but I didn't quite understand. So, in your release, you were saying that margins were broadly flat to the end of the first half. If we compare it to the actual reported margin in the first half, does that mean that they were down in the quarter?
No.
No, broadly flat.
So if I, versus the 2.47 that you reported in the first half, margins were broadly flat.
Well, 2.47 is the including markets, and we said that was broadly flat. But remember, we always focus on the margin excluding markets because you get all those compositional differences going on. Mm-hmm. And that was 2.81 for both Q1 and Q2 and is 2.83 for Q3.
Great.
Two basis points.
Okay, great. Understood. And secondly, just in terms of, as you said, the environment globally is certainly deteriorating, and I'm assuming a lot of the foreign banks are experiencing difficulties within their own operations. What does it mean for your aspirations in Asia? Does that mean that there are more opportunities both in terms of acquisitions and also opportunities for you to perhaps spend a little bit more in the short term to drive growth in the future?
Yeah, I mean, I think it provides an opportunity for us. You know, I think that there's going to be restriction on a number of European banks' balance sheet. You know, they're basically going to be strapped for capital, so they obviously will not be able to grow the risk-weighted assets in a way that they have previously. That's going to allow us an ability to move into that market more aggressively. Obviously, in terms of acquisitions, it's hard to say, but, you know, at some stage, many of these banks in Europe are actually now earning an ROE which is less than their cost of capital. Therefore, they're going to have to find ways of increasing capital. They can't always just tap the market at huge discount. And at some stage, you know, some of them will probably have to sell the family silver, which is the Asian assets. Well, I hope, anyway.
And in terms of organic growth?
Yeah, well, organic growth, as I say, I think this is an opportunity for us because as everybody else has to pull in the belt, we have the ability to continue to expand.
Great, thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Craig Williams from Citi. Please go ahead.
Yes, good morning. A couple of questions, if I could, please. Firstly, given your markets push throughout your business and your expansion offshore, do you envisage that there's a risk of more disparity between domestic banks on PCR settings when APRA determines capital settings under Basel III?
In terms of the geographical adjustment, Craig? Sorry, I didn't really understand.
Yeah, so one, the expansion into Asia, and two, the extent to which that is being driven by markets-based income.
I wouldn't necessarily agree that the expansion into Asia is being driven by markets. I mean, I'd say quite the opposite. The expansion into Asia is being driven by customer flow. It's being driven by the customer relationship, and the customer acquisition is continuing to grow. The products that are being sold into that customer base will include markets products, but that's very much more stable income than trading income. I think that I'd make that distinction.
Okay.
The second thing, under Basel III, in fact, if you have quite diverse geographical businesses, there is actually less capital requirement than if you were concentrated on one domestic business. Now, don't ask me why that's the case. That's some geniuses have thought that one up in Basel III. But the other issue, of course, is that the institutional business and corporate business is, of course, more capital intensive than retail business, which is, of course, got a higher element of mortgages, which requires less capital. So, it works both ways.
So, Craig, I just add in there that remember that if you're taking more or less market risk, your risk-weighted assets vary. So it should be picked up there. It doesn't require a change in PCR. It just means if you take more market risk, you have higher risk-weighted assets. Likewise, if you're taking more credit risk, you have higher risk-weighted assets. It doesn't prima facie require a higher capital ratio.
So net-net from all of that, expecting more disparity between Australian Bank PCR settings under Basel III than under Basel II?
Well, I think the main issue that we will have will be where APRA ends up in terms of its measurement approach. I think we could still have a disparity there in the sense that APRA may measure the Tier 1 ratio a different way to the way that's measured under Basel III.
The issue here, Craig, is that where there may be global consistency in terms of what a Tier 1 requirement is, the actual definition of risk-weighted assets is now seems to be different, or a different calculation is being used by every regulator. That's the issue.
Okay. And you've talked about the change reality now that we're into a financial crisis, which I'd say we're still in the midst of. Can you discuss tactical cost initiatives that you see for the business ex-New Zealand, where I think you've sort of indicated that you're having a go at things there?
Look, we run, we manage costs very much on an ongoing basis. It's a question of cutting, cutting the cloth to suit the size. You have to be dynamic on this. You just got to, we cut costs in one area, we invest in another. And that's how we have run the business and will continue to do so.
Okay, thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Jonathan Mott from UBS. Please go ahead.
Yeah, hi guys. Just a quick question. You did talk up a recovery in commercial lending that came through in that period through to the end of June. If you could just go into a bit more detail about that. Was that somewhat seasonal, firstly? Secondly, what areas is that coming through in the commercial side? And has it continued into July and August given the volatility and falling consumer confidence that we've seen in the last couple of months?
Yeah, we've actually seen it broadly across the across the business. There is an increase in volume in terms of people's interest in borrowing. I think it's easy to turn that question around, Jonathan, and actually say there are obviously some industries which are not looking at expansion, and those are. Retail, they're people who have been hit by the strong dollar. Manufacturing is obviously an issue, and tourism, if it's geared to US or European tourists. But I think tourism, if it's geared to Asia, seems to be working pretty well. So I would say there are certain sectors that are doing particularly well, and of course those, as you'd expect, those that are supplying and servicing the resources industry are picking up. So it's a sort of mixed picture, but it is broadly based across the country.
And has that continued over the last month or two?
Yes, it has. But obviously, the last 2 weeks are probably going to, are going to put a little bit of a stall on confidence, I would expect. But it's too soon to tell.
And also, you did mention before with the consumers starting to pay down debts a little bit faster. Are you seeing consumers just saving more with the deposit rate growth that you've seen, or are actually consumers more aggressively using that to pay down debt?
Well, I think they're doing both. But what they tend to be doing is traditionally paying down mortgages a little bit faster than maybe credit cards. That sort of defies logic a little bit. But we are actually seeing this increase in savings. So I would actually say there's more increase in savings than there is in paying down of debt.
Thank you.
Thank you. The next question comes from the line of James Freeman from Deutsche Bank. Please go ahead.
Hi, Mike. I just wanted to actually get some clarification just on your outlook for your trading book. I mean, you've mentioned the fourth quarter number, still getting some challenges. There's been a rumour floating around the market suggesting you guys took a big hit in the last couple of weeks. So I was just hoping you could actually put that rumour to bed or give us some clarity on that. And just the second question I have was just actually following on from the cost opportunity. I noticed there was no sort of cost growth numbers in this release. Just if we could get an idea as to how the third quarter went in terms of cost growth, and do you believe that ANZ can ever get back to, or can ever deliver a flat cost outcome over the next couple of years, or is the growth in Asia going to see the cost line continue to move forward?
Yeah, I mean as I said to you, you know, we've got a high revenue, high cost model. However, you know, they have to be worked together, and that will continue. So if income does come off very significantly, then so will cost. And that will, you know, that will remain. In terms of the trading book, I know there were a number of rumours which weren't helped by a number of bits of research that came out with, you know, which sort of fueled the rumours. But frankly, I mean, most of that was complete rubbish. I mean, if you look at the trading book, we actually have, you know, we're still up year on year. It's still in positive territory. It's just that we haven't made as much money as we did the year before or the year before that. So, you know, I think that's the best way to describe it. The as I said at the moment, the outlook is for one of further volatility, or very, very difficult to predict volatility, where we would rather run a very low risk strategy and not necessarily make money, but certainly not lose it. And so whilst markets remain like this, that will continue.
Thanks, Mike.
And James, in terms of your cost your cost question, quarter on quarter costs were up 0.7%. If you FX adjust, it would be 1.7%. But in terms of the raw numbers, up 0.7% quarter on quarter.
Great, thanks for that, guys.
Your next question comes from the line of Andrew Lyons from Royal Bank of Scotland. Please go ahead.
Good morning, everyone. Your mortgage volumes in New Zealand appeared a bit weaker against system. Can you maybe just make some comments on your sort of outlook for volumes in that market and how you expect your franchise to grow within that over maybe the next 12, 24 months, please?
Yeah, I mean, we basically set out to maintain growth at system for the year. And, you know, that was the strategy. Now, what happened at the beginning of the year was that we got up to, I think, 1.4 times system growth in the first 2-3 months. And then we sort of scaled back, and we probably scaled back too much, and we're now picking up again. And so, again, we'll hopefully end the year at about system or just above system growth. And I'm comfortable with that, because what we wanted to do was, as I say, maintain that market share, but maintain our margin and pricing, and most importantly, maintain the quality of the mortgages. So our underwriting standards have not changed at all. Is this about New Zealand?
Yeah.
My apologies. I was answering about Australia. Right. Sorry. What was the question in New Zealand?
Same question.
Precisely that question.
Okay. In New Zealand, again, it's been more around quality. We have not until recently moved the underwriting standards up, particularly on the loan to value. You know, we are presently now have adjusted those slightly for customers that we know. So I think that was more a quality issue rather than anything else. And I'm, you know, we're happy with where we stand on that. Hello.
Your next question comes from the line of Scott Manning from JP Morgan. Please go ahead.
Good morning. Just wanted to see if you could give us some observations on how the businesses are going in Asia, what liquidity is like up there, funding, demand for credit, just how things at the kind of macro level are going.
Yeah, I mean, I think the conditions are still pretty buoyant in Asia. There has been consistent demand for credit within Asia. Liquidity has not been a problem until the last couple of weeks, although we were beginning to see a tightening of US dollars, particularly in Hong Kong. And that really was as a result of people taking Hong Kong dollars or US dollars and basically buying renminbi assets. Well, why wouldn't you at the time? But of course, you know, now that's sort of slightly changed with the crisis of the last 2 weeks. So it's harder to read where liquidity is at the moment. In terms of our own liquidity, of course, we're in a very good position. And indeed, with the weakening dollar, of course, we got a huge inflow through our CSAs of cash, primarily in US dollars. And the issue there was, what to do with it. Because, of course, treasuries weren't giving us a massive return. So, it's still pretty buoyant. Margins have actually pushed out a little bit in Asia. That's been the good effect of the last few months and this tighter liquidity. So that has worked to our favour.
Do you need to adjust your settings for the business at all, given the expectation that you're stuck in this low rate environment in the US, and therefore any potential deposit expansion that was on the cards in the Asian business has been put back to any degree?
Well, it's a question of being dynamic with it and adjusting for it. You know, at the moment, we've been able to build substantial domestic deposits in Australia, so we haven't needed to tap the Asian market. But we continue to turn away deposits in Asia, and we've rather done that than turn away domestic deposits here. But at some stage, I expect that we'll see a movement from bank deposits in Australia into the wealth side as people look for a higher post-tax yield, and at that time we'll turn the tap back on for Asia. So at the moment, we've been able to just manage that position quite nicely, and it's good to have that that flexibility and the ability to tap that market if we need.
Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Matthew Davidson from Merrill Lynch. Please go ahead.
Oh, good morning, gentlemen. My question just related to the lending spreads in Asia that you said had improved. I was just interested if you've seen an acceleration in loan growth in that region on the back of that. And then I guess as a partly related question, if we go back to the last crisis, the AA rating really helped ANZ in the region in terms of its position in markets, etc. I was just interested if you view that as likely to recur this time round, and if you see a downgrade in the next few months from S&P, what were your feelings around how that would affect your relative position in markets in Asia?
To answer your first part of the question, we're still seeing quite good loan demand in Asia that continues. I don't think it's really been affected massively by events, so that continues to be fairly positive. In terms of the rating, yes, it helps to have the AA rating. There are governments, there are government agencies, and indeed corporates who will only deal with banks of a certain rating, and of course that club of AA banks has reduced considerably, and so that does play to our advantage, particularly offshore. Now, talking about any re-rating, we're not aware of any re-rating, but we all know that Standard & Poor's are looking at these things, but they're looking at the whole banking industry. And the issue will be the relativity, because it won't actually matter if everybody is regraded, because it's the relativity, and I can't see any reason why we would lose our existing relative grading or rating vis-a-vis the other global banks.
Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Mike Wiblin from Macquarie. Please go ahead.
Morning, Mike. Just a question on deposit growth and, I suppose, deployment of those deposits. You've had exceptional deposit growth relative to peers, but the loan growth has obviously been reasonably subdued. I wonder whether, you know, is there any option there to perhaps go a little harder on price and also just more broadly in the Australian market, just in terms of corporate lending, but also on mortgages? Any views on that?
I mean, you know, we're trying to hold the margin. I think we've done that successfully and have managed that well. You know, I think we're pricing for risk appropriately on the asset side of the book. And indeed, I think we've been competitive, but we have not been out of market in terms of our deposit pricing. And in fact, you know, again, we are certainly not the most aggressive in the market. In fact, far from it. What we have done, though, is made a very deliberate effort to reduce our loan-to-deposit ratio. You know, basically, we felt that the we needed to improve that core funding ratio, and which we have done, and reduce the reliance on wholesale funding. And at a time like this, you know, that looks like a quite sensible thing to have done.
Has that got through the... Sorry.
Yeah, so I think maybe...
All I was going to add, you're asking about deposit deployment. And obviously, one of the things that we've been deploying deposits towards is not having to raise as much term borrowing. So you see, we've said we've completed our term borrowing program for the year. We ended up needing to raise far less than what we originally thought because our deposits were so strong.
Okay. And just a bit more of a broader macro question. Oh, yes, yeah, the market is speculating pretty heavily at the moment about the global growth outlook, which looks like it's declining pretty rapidly. I mean, last time around, we saw trade sort of came off quite steeply as well, particularly Asian trade. I mean, what is the read-through from your perspective of, you know, if we do see that kind of global growth come off, do we see a fairly, you know, a steep decline in Asian trade, and what's the outlook for ANZ in that regard?
You know, I'm still relatively positive about global trade. I think we will see a reduction from what we thought was going to happen, say, 6 months ago. And really that's off the back of the US issue more than anything. I think Europe, you know, that had already been discounted to an extent. You know, I think the amount of inter-regional trade within Europe is probably going to be fairly consistent. And it's the U.S. which is the big issue, and that has recovered more slowly than we thought. But again, if you look at corporate earnings in the U.S., they're still pretty good. Productivity gains continue to be pretty high, and we still are seeing you know, fairly significant trade volumes move around the world. So. Whilst there may be a little bit of a blip and you know, confidence gets whacked occasionally in times like this, I'm still pretty positive. And again, I think, you know, if you look at Australia in terms of where Australia fits in the rest of the world, you know, we have a country which has got a good fiscal position. You know, it's still a AAA country. We're on the we're right on the hinterland of the only part of the world which is truly, truly moving, you know, I think it's very positive.
Okay, thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Ben Zucker from CBA Equities. Please go ahead.
Good morning. Just two questions, please. So the first was around bad debt charge. Previously, you'd commented about the charge for the full year likely to be around $1.3 billion or so, and just noticed there was no comment today, and just wondering how you think the bad debt side of things is tracking. And the second question was around your comments on investment in Asia and the change with the maturing of the business there. Just wanted to understand how significantly you view that shift in terms of investment dollars required going forward into those businesses.
Okay, well, if I answer the second part of the question first. You know, we continue to expand our business, and as you know, our strategy is based on organic growth, you know, which is what I like because it's one times book. And there is no premium to it, so you know that will continue. But that doesn't mean we're not on the lookout for acquisitions. We continue to do that, but acquisitions by their nature have to be opportunistic, and you know the stars have to align. And as we've always said, we are very, very disciplined on the criteria which we use for acquisitions. And, you know, I'm patient. You know, I'll just wait until the right opportunities come. In terms of the provision numbers, Peter's got some information on that.
Yeah, Ben, I think the key observations to make is you can see from the Q3 that there's been no surprises coming out from an individual provisions point of view. And in particular, one of the things that means is that there's been very little coming out in terms of any effect from the Queensland floods. So something certainly during Q4 we'll have to reassess just what the amount of the CP required for the Queensland floods would be. So I would suggest then that the provision for Q4 is probably likely to be a little bit lower than Q3.
Got you. Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of T.S. Lim from Bell Potter. Please go ahead.
Oh, good morning, guys. Mike, now that Ralph's leaving the bank, you're going to be the most senior banker of the majors. Just wanted to know what your feel is for the outlook. You know, are you a glass half full or glass half empty kind of person? And what's keeping you up at night right now?
Can I answer that question?
Yes, well, I've always been a glass half full person, and I don't intend to change. Having said that, I think I'm realistically conservative in outlook. But I think we've got an extraordinary opportunity really in this region over the next few years, and I think that really realizing that opportunity is going to be the secret. You know, it's all in the execution. So I'm pretty positive looking forward. And what's keeping me up at night? Not much, really. I mean, I think that I would like to see the stability back in the credit markets. I think what we've seen in equity markets is quite reactive to really what's happening in credit markets. And I think it's the credit markets that are key. And really, I can't see that really being stabilized until we get some true leadership out of Europe. And to solve these issues around the euro problem and the debt problems within the sovereign the various sovereign countries in Europe. So until that really gets fundamentally sorted out, I think we're going to frankly have more of this type of volatility, which doesn't make life that easy.
All right. Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Brian Johnson from CLSA. Please go ahead.
Hi, Mike. I have three questions, but the first one is one specifically for you. Mike, you've always struck me as a pretty sensible bloke. Could you just give us some quick thoughts on what you think about this Bankwest Home Loan product, 97% LVR, but they won't lend it to you unless you earn over $80,000 a year on a home loan? It looks a bit scary to me, but I'd be interested on your thoughts.
Well, let me put it this way. We don't have a product like that.
But what is it? What does it mean for overall housing?
Well, I've no idea. I think what has been very important for us is to maintain the quality of our mortgage book. You know, we've always seen that as a priority. It's easy to chase market share with products which are less strict, or with pricing which is lower than alternatives, but we have never believed that was necessary. And I think underwriting standards to me are absolutely critical.
So, Mike, can you hold share without compromising underwriting standards?
Well, we have done so far.
Mm.
Because there's more to it. There's more to it than that. It's the type of customer you want. You know, most of our customers are the ones that we want. You know, and there's more to buying a mortgage than just how much LVR is or what the price is. You know, there's issues around service and loyalty and connectivity and indeed convenience. But the service element is also incredibly strong. So, you know, it's not the only driver.
Okay. A question for Peter, if I may. Peter, could you clarify, on today's call, loan growth is up in Asia. You're turning away Asian deposits. Could you clarify for us how many Asian deposits have been streamed down to Australia? And then following that, could you tell us what the current balances of liquidity is, break it up between the level one, the level two, and the internal securitisation, what the bare minimum regulatory requirement is at the moment, and what you think it would be based on the current scenario for the liquidity coverage ratio?
Well, Brian, taking your first question, which was around the amount of deposits being streamed down from Asia. They're down a bit. We I think we're about 15, 16 billion at the end of March. It's around about 11 billion at the end of June. As we always said, this amount moves up and down depending on the flows.
Yeah, it's been replaced by...
It's been very strong. The domestic deposit growth, so there's been less need for money streamed down from Asia. In terms of your questions around liquidity cover ratio and those sorts of things, I think we really... You know, we think that APRA is going to be coming out with its guidance on this very soon. I think it's best to wait till we actually see the rules and then start talking about those things rather than speculating until we actually see what APRA is requiring. And as I understand it, that's something which should be there before 30 September, and we'll obviously give that sort of detail for you at the full year rather than now.
So, Peter, you can't just kind of illuminate us on what the current Basel II liquidity position is then?
Well, relative to Basel II, liquidity is very strong. You know, we run much stronger ratios than what APRA requires. But that's not the binding constraint. The binding constraint is going to be what's required under Basel III. The management policies are far higher than what's required under APRA's current policy.
Thank you.
That does conclude today's question and answer session. I will now hand back to Ms. Crane for any additional or closing remarks.
Thank you, Kay, and thank you, everyone. If you have any follow-up questions through the day, obviously you can give the Investor Relations team a call. Thank you all for joining us, and we'll talk to you at the full-year results in November.
Many thanks.
Thank you.
That does conclude today's conference. Thank you all for participating. You may now disconnect.